There was a haystack behind a livery stable in Phaedra Road. It bulged for a moment and there was a muffled swearing. A fraction of a second later there was a bout of coughing and another much better swear word inside a grain silo down near the cattle market. Very shortly after that, some rotten floorboards in an old feed store in Short Street exploded upwards, followed by a swear word that bounced off a flour sack.
"Idiot rodent!"
bellowed Albert, fingering grain out of his ear.
"Squeak! I should think so! What size do you think I am?"
Albert brushed hay and flour off his coat and walked over to the window.
"Ah," he said, "let us repair to the mended drum, then."
In Albert's pocket, sand resumed its interrupted journey from future to past. Hibiscus Dunelm had decided to close up for an hour. It was a simple process. First, he and his staff collected any unbroken mugs and glasses. This didn't take long. Then there was a desultory search for any weapons with a high resale value, and a quick search of any pockets whose owners were unable to object on account of being drunk, dead, or both. Then the furniture was moved aside, and everything else was swept out of the back door and into the broad brown bosom of the River Ankh, where it piled up and by degrees sank. Finally, Hibiscus locked and bolted the big front door. It wouldn't shut. He looked down. A boot was wedged in it.
"We're shut," he said. "No, you ain't."
The door ground back and Albert was inside.
"Have you seen this person?"
he demanded, thrusting a pasteboard oblong in front of Dunelm's eyes. This was a gross breach of etiquette. Dunelm wasn't in the kind of job where you survived if you told people you'd seen people. Dunelm could serve drinks all night without seeing anyone.
"Never seen him before in my life,"
he said, automatically, without even looking at the card.
"You've got to help me," said Albert, "otherwise something dreadful will happen. Push off."
Albert kicked the door shut behind him.
"Just don't say I didn't warn you," he said.
On his shoulder, the death of rats sniffed the air suspiciously. A moment later, Hibiscus was having his chin pressed firmly into the boards of one of his tables.
"Now, I know he'd come in here,"
said Albert, who wasn't even breathing heavily,
"because everyone does, sooner or later. Have another look."
"That's a Karok card," said Hibiscus indistinctly. "That's death."
"That's right. He's the one on the white horse. You can't miss him. Only he wouldn't look like that in here, I expect."
"Let me get this straight," said the landlord, trying desperately to wriggle out of the iron grip. "You want me to tell you if I've seen someone who doesn't look like that?"
"He'd have been odd. Odder than most."
Albert thought for a moment.
"And he'd have drunk a lot, if I know him. He always does. This is Ankh Morpork, you know. Don't be cheeky or I'll get angry."
"You mean you're not angry now?"
"I'm just impatient. You can try for angry if you like. There was someone a few days ago. Can't remember exactly what he looked like." "Ah, oh, that'd be him.
Drank me dry, complained about the barbarian invaders game, got legless and then..."
"What?"
"Can't recall. We just threw him out."
"Out the back door?"
"Yes."
"But that's just river out there."
"Well, most people come round before the sink."
"Squeak,"
said the death of rats.
"Did he say anything?"
said Albert, too busy to pay attention.
"Something about remembering everything, I think. He said being drunk didn't make him forget. Kept going on about doorknobs and..."
"Hairy sunlight." "Hairy sunlight?"
"Something like that."
And the pressure on Hibiscus's arm was suddenly released. He waited a second or two and then very cautiously turned his head. There was no one behind him. Very carefully, Hibiscus bent down to look under the tables. Albert stepped out into the dawn and, after some fumbling, produced his box. He opened it and glanced at his lifetimer, then snapped the lid shut.
"All right,"
he said.
"What next?"
"Squeak."
"What?" And someone hit him across the head. It wasn't a killing stroke. Timo Laziman of the Thieves' Guild knew what happened to thieves who killed people. The Assassins' Guild came and talked briefly to them. In fact, all they said was goodbye. All he'd wanted to do was knock the old man out so that he could rifle his pockets. He'd not expected the sound as the body hit the ground. It was like the tinkle of broken glass, but with unpleasant overtones that carried on echoing into Timo's ears long after they should have stopped. Something leapt from the body and whirred into his face. Two skeletal claws grabbed his ears and a bony muzzle jerked forward and hit him hard on the forehead. He screamed and ran for it. The death of rats dropped to the ground again and scurried back to Albert. It patted his face, kicked him frantically a few times, and then in desperation bit him on the nose. Then it grabbed Albert's collar and tried to pull him out of the gutter, but there was a warning tinkle of glass. The eye sockets turned madly towards the drum's closed front door. Ossified whiskers bristled. A moment later, Hibiscus opened the door, if only to stop the thunderous knocking.
"I said we..."
Something shot between his legs, paused momentarily to bite him on the ankle, and scuttled towards the back door, nose pressed firmly to the floor. It was called Hyde Park, not because people could, but because a hide was once a measure of land capable of being ploughed by one man with 3½ oxen on a wet Thursday, and the park was exactly this amount of land, and people in Ankh-Morpork stick to tradition, and often to other things as well. And it had trees and grass, and a lake with actual fish in it. And by one of those twists of civic history, it was a fairly safe place. People seldom got mugged in Hyde Park. Muggers like somewhere safe to sunbathe, just like everyone else. It was, as it were, neutral territory. And it was already filling up, even though there was nothing much to see except the workmen still hammering together a large stage by the lake. An area behind it had been walled off with strips of cheap sacking nailed to stakes. Occasionally, excited people would try to get in and would be thrown into the lake by Chrysoprase's trolls. Among the practicing musicians, Crash and his group were immediately noticeable, partly because Crash had his shirt off so that Jimbo could paint iodine on the wounds.
"I thought you were joking," he growled.
I did say it was in your bedroom," said Scum.
"How am I going to play my guitar like this?" said Crash.
"You can't play your guitar anyway," said Noddy.
"I mean, look at my hand. Look at it."
They looked at his hand. Jimbo's mum had put a glove on it after treating the wounds. They hadn't been very deep, because even a stupid leopard won't hang around anyone who wants to take his trousers off.
"A glove," said Crash in a terrible voice. "Whoever heard of a serious musician with a glove? How can I ever play my guitar with a glove on?"
"How could you ever play your guitar anyway?" "I don't know why I put up with you three," said Crash.
You're cramping my artistic development. I'm thinking of leaving and forming my own band."
"No, you won't," said Jimbo, "because you won't find anyone even worse than us. Let's face it, we're rubbish."
He was voicing a hitherto unspoken yet shared thought. The other musicians around them were, it was true, quite bad, but that's all they were. Some of them had some minor musical talent. As for the rest, they merely couldn't play. They didn't have a drummer who missed the drums, and a bass guitarist with the same natural rhythm as a traffic accident. And they generally settled on their name. They might be unimaginative names, like A Big Troll and Some Other Trolls, or Dwarfs with Altitude, but at least they knew who they were.
"How about We're a Rubbish Band?" said Noddy, sticking his hands in his pockets.
"We may be rubbish," snarled Crash, "but we're music with rocks in rubbish." "Well, well, well, and how's it all going, then?" said Dibbler, pushing his way through the sacking. "It won't be long now. What are you doing here?"
"We're in the programme, Mr. Dibbler," said Crash meekly.
"How can you be in the programme when I don't know what you're called?"
said Dibbler, waving a hand irritably at one of the posters.
"Your name up there, is it?"
"We're probably where it says, and supporting bands," said Noddy.
"What happened to your hand?" said Dibbler.
"My trousers bit it," said Crash, glowering at Scum. "Honest, Mr. Dibbler, can't you give us one more chance?"
"We'll see," said Dibbler, and strode away.
He was feeling too cheerful to argue much. The sausages in a bun were selling very fast, but they were just covering minor expenses. There were ways of making money out of music with rocks in that he'd never thought of, and C.M.O.T. Dibbler thought of money all the time. For example, there were the shirts. They were of cotton so cheap and thin that it was practically invisible in a good light and tended to dissolve in the wash. He'd sold 600 already, at $5 each. All he had to do was buy them a 10 for a dollar from Clatchy and Wholesale Trading and pay Chalky $0.50 each to print them. And Chalky, with untroll-like initiative, had even printed off his own shirts. They said,
"Chalky's 12, the Scourers, Things Done."
And people were buying them, paying money to advertise Chalky's workshop. Dibbler had never dreamed that the world could work like this. It was like watching sheep shear themselves. Whatever was causing this reversal of the laws of commercial practice, he wanted in big lumps. He'd already sold the idea to Plugger the shoemaker in New Cobblers. Pluggers, they've got souls, feel the nails. And 100 shirts had just walked out of the shop, which was more than Plugger's merchandise usually did. People wanted clothes just because they had writing on. He was making money, thousands of dollars in a day, and 100 music traps were lined up in front of the stage, ready to capture Buddy's voice. If it went on at this rate, in several billion years, he'd be rich beyond his wildest dreams. Long live music with rocks in. There was only one small cloud in this silver lining. The festival was due to start at noon. Dibbler had planned to put on a lot of the small bad groups first, that is to say, all of them, and finish with the band. So there was no reason to worry if they weren't here right now. But they weren't here right now. Dibbler was worried. A tiny dark figure quartered the shores of the Ankh, moving so fast as to be a blur. It zigzagged desperately back and forth, snuffling. People didn't see it, but they saw the rats, black, brown and grey. They were leaving the godowns and wharfs by the river, running over one another's backs in a determined attempt to get as far away as possible. A haystack heaved and gave birth to a glod. He rolled out onto the ground and groaned. Fine rain was drifting over the landscape. Then he staggered upright, looked around at the rolling fields, and disappeared behind a hedge for the moment. He trotted back a few seconds later, explored the haystack for a while until he found a part that was lumpier than normal, and kicked it repeatedly with his metal-topped boot.
"Oh! C-flat," said Glod. "Good morning, Cliff. Hello, world. I don't think I can stand life in the fast ley line, you know, the cabbages, the bad beer, all those rats pestering you all the time."
Cliff crawled out.
"I must have had some bad ammonium chloride last night," he said. "Is the top of my head still on?"
"Yes."
"Pity."
They hauled asphalt out by his boots and brought him round by pounding him repeatedly.
"You are our road manager," said Glod. "You're supposed to see no harm comes to us." "Well, I'm doing that, ain't I?" asphalt muttered. "I'm not hitting you, Mr. Glod." "Where's Buddy?"
The three circled the haystack, prodding at bulges which turned out to be damp hay. They found him on a small rise in the ground, not very far away. A few holly bushes grew there, carved into curves by the wind. He was sitting under one, guitar on his knees, rain plastering his hair to his face. He was asleep and soaking wet. On his lap, the guitar played raindrops.
"He's weird," said Asphalt. "No," said Glod, "he's wound up by some strange compulsion which leads him through dark pathways." "Yeah, weird."
The rain was slackening off. Cliff glanced at the sky.
"Sun's high," he said.
"Oh, no," said Asphalt. "How long were you asleep?"
"Same as I am awake," said Cliff.
"It's almost noon. Where did I leave the horses? Has anyone seen the cart? Someone wake him up."
A few minutes later, they were back on the road.
"And you know what?" said Cliff. "We left so quick last night, I never did know she turned up."
"What was her name?" said Glod.
"Dunno," said the troll.
"Oh, that's real love, that is," said Glod.
"Ain't you got any romance in your soul?" said Cliff.
"Eyes crossed in a crowded room," said Glod.
"Nah, not really." They were pushed aside as Buddy leaned forward.
"Shut up," he said.
The voice was low and contained no trace whatsoever of humour.
"We were only joking," said Glod.
"Don't!"
Asphalt concentrated on the road, aware of the general lack of amiability.
"I expect you're looking forward to the festival, eh?" he said, after a while.
No one replied.
"I expect there'll be big crowds," he said.
There was a silence except for the clatter of the hooves and the rattle of the cart. They were in the hills now, where the road wound alongside a gorge. There wasn't even a river down there, except in the wettest season. It was a gloomy area. Asphalt felt that it was getting gloomier.
"I expect you'll really have fun," he said eventually. "Asphalt," said Glod.
"Yes, Mr. Glod?"
"Watch the road, will you?"
The Arch-Chancellor polished his staff as he walked along. It was a particularly good one, 6 feet long and quite magical. Not that he used magic very much. In his experience, anything that couldn't be disposed of with a couple of whacks from 6 feet of oak was probably immune to magic as well.
"Don't you think we should have brought the senior wizard, sir?"
said Ponda, struggling to keep up.
"I'm afraid that taking them along in their present frame of mind would only make whatever happens," Ridcully sought for a useful phrase and settled for "happen worse. I've insisted they stay in college."
"How about Drongo and the others?"
said Ponda, hopefully.
"Would they be any good in the event of a thaumaturgical dimension rip of enormous proportions?" said Ridcully.
"I remember poor old Mr. Hong. One minute he was dishing up an order of double cod and mushy peas, and the next—"
"Kaboom?"
said Ponda.
"Kaboom?" said Ridcully, forcing his way up the crowded street.
"Not that I heard tell.
More like, ah, 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 scream, gristle, 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 crack, and a shower of fried food. Big mad Adrian and his friends any good when the chips are down?"
Probably not, Arch-Chancellor.
Correct. People shout and run about. That never did any good. A pocketful of decent spells and a well-charged staff will get you out of trouble 9 times out of 10.
9 times out of 10?
Correct.
How many times have you had to rely on them, sir?
Well, there was Mr. Hong, that business with the thing in the bursar's wardrobe, that dragon, you remember?
Ridcully's lips moved silently as he counted on his fingers.
9 times so far.
And it worked every time, sir?
Absolutely. So, there's no need to worry. Gangway! Wizard coming through!
The city gates were open. Glod leaned forward as the cart rumbled in.
"Don't go straight to the park," he said.
"But we're late," said Ashfeld.
"This won't take long. Go to the Street of Cunning Artificers first."
"That's right, on the other side of the river. It's important. We've got to pick up something."
People flocked the streets. This wasn't unusual, except that this time most of them were moving the same way.
"And you get down in the back of the cart,"
said Glod to Buddy.
"We don't want young women trying to rip your clothes off, eh, Buddy?"
He turned, and Buddy had gone to sleep again.
"Speaking for myself," Cliff began.
"You've only got a loincloth," said Glod.
"Well, they could grab it, couldn't they?"
The cart threaded its way through the streets until it turned into Cunning Artificers. It was a street of tiny shops. In this street you could have anything made, repaired, crafted, rebuilt, copied, or forged. Furnaces glowed in every doorway. Smelters smoked in every backyard. Makers of intricate clockwork eggs worked alongside armourers. Carpenters worked next door to men who carved ivory into tiny shapes so delicate that they used grasshoppers' legs cast in bronze for saws. At least one in every four craftsmen was making tools to be used by the other three. Shops didn't just abut, they overlapped. If a carpenter had a big table to make, he relied on the goodwill of his neighbours to make space so that he'd be working on one end of it while two jewellers and a potter were using the other end as a bench. There were shops where you could drop in to be measured in the morning and pick up a complete suit of chainmail with an extra pair of pants in the afternoon. The cart stopped outside one small shop, and Glod leapt down and went inside. Ashfeld heard the conversation.
"Have you done it?"
"Here you are, mister. Right as rain."
"Will it play? You know I said where you have to have spent a fortnight wrapped in a bullock hide behind a waterfall before you should touch one of these things?"
"Listen, mister, for this kind of money, it had me in the shower for 5 minutes with a chamois leather on me head. Don't tell me that's not good enough for folk music."
There was a pleasant sound which hung in the air for a moment before being lost in the busy din of the street.
"We said $20, right?"
"No, you said $20. I said $25.
Just a minute, then."
Glod came out and nodded at Cliff.
"All right," he said. "Cough up."
Cliff growled, but fumbled for a moment somewhere at the back of his mouth. They heard the cunning artificer say,
"What the hell's that?" "A molar. Got to be worth at least. It'll do."
Glod came out again with a sack, which he tucked under the seat.
"Okay," he said. "Head for the park."
They went in through one of the back gates, or at least tried to. Two trolls barred their way. They had the glossy marble patina of Chrysoprase's basic gang thugs. He didn't have henchmen. Most trolls weren't clever enough to hench.
"This is for the bands," one said. "That's right," said the other one. "We are the band," said Ashfeld.
"Which one?" said the first troll.
"I got a list here."
"That's right."
"'We're the band with Roxine,' said Clod.
"'Eh, you ain't them. I've seen them. There's a guy with this glow round him, and when he plays the guitar, it goes...
"'That's right.'
The cord curled around the cart. Buddy was standing up, guitar at the ready.
"'Oh, wow,' said the first troll. "'This are amazing.'
He fumbled in his loincloth and produced a dog-eared piece of paper.
"'You couldn't write your name down, could you? My boy Clay, he won't believe I met.'
"'Yes, yes,' said Buddy wearily. "'Pass it up.'
"'Only it's not for me. It's for my boy Clay,' said the troll, jumping from one foot to the other in excitement.
"'How do you spell it?'
"'It don't matter. He can't read anyway.'
"'Listen,' said Glod, as the cart trundled into the backstage area. "'Someone's already playing. I said we—'
Dibbler hurried up.
"'What kept you?' he said. "'You'll be on soon, right after Boys from the Wood.' "'How did it go? Ashfelt, come here.'
He pulled a small troll into the shadows at the back of the stage.
"'You brought me some money?'
he said.
"'About 3,000. Not so loud. I'm only whispering it, Mr. Dibbler.'
Dibbler looked around carefully. There was no such thing as a whisper in Ankh-Morpork when the sum involved had the word thousand in it somewhere. People could hear you think that kind of money in Ankh-Morpork.
You be sure and keep an eye on it, right? There's going to be more before this day's out. I'll give Chryso Praise's $700 and the rest is all pro...
He caught Ashfelt's little beady eye and remembered himself.
Of course, there's depreciation overhead, some advertising market research buns, mustard, basically. I'll be lucky if I break even. I'm practically cutting me own throat on this deal.
Yes, Mr. Dibbler.
Ashfelt peered around the edge of the stage.
Who's that playing now, Mr. Dibbler?
And you.
Sorry, Mr. Dibbler.
Only they write it. And you, said Dibbler.
He relaxed a little and pulled out a cigar.
Don't ask me why. The right kind of name for a musician ought to be something like Blondie and his Merry Troubadours. Are they any good?
Don't you know, Mr. Dibbler?
It's not what I call music, said Dibbler. When I was a lad, we had proper music with real words. Summaries are coming in, newly sing cuckoo. That sort of thing.
Ashfelt looked at And You again.
"'Well, it's got a beat and you can dance to it,' he said. "'But they're not very good. "'I mean, people are just watching them. "'They don't just watch when the band are playing, Mr. Dibbler.'
"'You're right,' said Dibbler.
"'He looked at the front of the stage. "'In between the candles was a row of music traps.
"'You'd better go and tell them to get ready. "'I think this lot are running out of ideas.'
"'Buddy?' "'He looked up from his guitar.' Some of the other musicians were tuning theirs, but he'd found he never had to. He couldn't, anyway. The pegs didn't move.
What is it?
Said Glod. He waved vaguely at Cliff, who grinned sheepishly and produced the sack from behind his back.
This is... well, we thought that is all of us, said Glod. That, well, we saw it, you see, and I know you said it couldn't be repaired, but there's people in this city that can do just about anything... So we asked around, and we knew how much it meant to you, and there's this man in the street of cunning artificers, and he said he thought he could do it, and it cost Cliff another tooth, but here you are anyway, because you're right. We're on top of the music business right enough, and it's because of you, and we know how much this meant to you, so it's a sort of thank you present. Well, go on then, give it to him.
Cliff, who lowered his arm again as the sentence began to extend, pushed the sack towards the puzzled Buddy. Ashfelt poked his head through the sacking.
"'We guys better get on the stage,' he said. "'Come on.'
Buddy put down the guitar. He opened the sack and began to pull at the linen wrappings inside.
"'It's been tuned up and everything,' said Cliff helpfully.
The harp gleamed in the sun as the last wrapping came off.
"'They can do amazing things with glue and stuff.' said Glod. I mean, I know you said there wasn't anyone left in Hlamedos that could repair it, but this is Ankh-Morpork. We can fix nearly everything.
Please, said Ashfelt, as his head reappeared. Mr. Dibbler says you've got to come. They've started to throw things.
I don't know much about strings, said Glod, but I had a go. Sounds kind of nice.
I don't know what to say, said Buddy.
The chanting was like a hammer.
"'Won this,' said Buddy, in a small, distant world of his own, "'with a song, Sione Bodda, it was.
I worked on it all winter. All about home, you know, and going away, see, and trees and things. The judges were very pleased. They said that in 50 years I might really understand music.
He pulled the harp towards him. Dibbler pushed his way through the rabble of musicians backstage until he found Ashfeld.
Well, he said, where are they?
They're just sitting around talking, Mr. Dibbler.
Listen, said Dibbler, you hear the crowd? It's music with rocks in they want. If they don't get it, well, they just better get it, all right? Letting the anticipation build up is all very well, but I want them on stage right now.
Buddy stared at his fingers. Then he looked up, white-faced, at the other bands milling around.
You, with the guitar, he said hoarsely.
Me, sir? Give it to me.
Every nascent rock group in Ankh-Morpork was in awe of the band with rocks in. The guitarist handed his instrument over with the expression of one passing over a holy item to be blessed. Buddy stared at it. It was one of Mr. Wee Down's best. He struck a chord. The sound sounded like lead would sound if you could make guitar strings out of it.
Okay, boys, what's the problem?
Said Dibbler, hurrying towards them.
There's 6,000 ears out there waiting to be filled up with music, and you're still sitting around.
Buddy handed the guitar back to the musician and swung his own instrument around on its strap. He played a few notes that seemed to twinkle in the air.
But I can play this, he said. Oh, yes.
Right, good. Now, get up there and play it, said Dibbler.
Someone else give me a guitar.
Musicians fell over themselves to hand them to him. He strummed frantically at a couple, but the notes weren't simply flat. Flat would have been an improvement. The Musicians Guild contingent had managed to secure an area close to the stage by the simple expedient of hitting any encroachers very hard. Mr. Cleet scowled at the stage.
I don't understand it, he said. It's rubbish. It's all the same. It's just noise. What's so good about it?
Satchel Mouth, who had twice had to stop himself tapping his feet, said,
We haven't had the main band yet. Are you sure you want to...
We're within our rights, said Cleet.
He looked around at the shouting people. There's a hot dog seller over there. Anyone else fancy a hot dog? Hot dog? The guild men nodded.
Hot dog? Right. There's three hot dog...
The audience cheered. It wasn't the way that an audience normally applauds, with it starting at one point and rippling outwards, but all at once, every single mouth opening at the same time. Cliff had knuckled onto the stage. He sat down behind his rocks and looked desperately back towards the wings. Glod trailed on, blinking in the lights. And that seemed to be it. The dwarf turned and said something, which was lost in the noise, and then stood looking awkward while the cheers gradually subsided. Buddy came on, staggering slightly as if he'd been pushed. Up until then, Mr. Cleet had thought that the crowd was yelling. And then he realized that it had been a mere murmur of approval compared to what was happening now. It went on and on while the boy stood there, head bowed.
But he's not doing anything, Cleet shouted into Satchel Mouth's ear. Why are they all cheering him for not doing anything?
Can't say, sir, said Satchel Mouth.
He looked around at the glistening, staring, hungry faces, feeling like an atheist who has wandered into Holy Communion. The applause went on. It redoubled again when Buddy slowly raised his hands to the guitar.
He's not doing anything, screamed Cleet.
He's got us bang to rights, sir. Satchel Mouth bellowed. He's not guilty of playing without belonging to the guild if he doesn't play.
Buddy looked up. He stared at the audience so intently that Cleet craned to see what it was that the wretched boy was staring at. It was nothing. There was a patch of it right in front of the stage. People were packed tight everywhere else, but there, right in front of the stage, was a little area of cleared grass. It seemed to rivet Buddy's attention.
Wah!
Cleet rammed his hands over his ears, but the force of the cheering made his head echo. And then, very gradually, layer by layer, it died away. It yielded to the sound of thousands of people being very quiet, which was somehow, Satchel Mouth thought, a lot more dangerous. Glod glanced at Cliff, who made a face. Buddy was still standing, staring at the audience.
If he doesn't play, Glod thought, then we've had it.
He hissed at Ashfeld, who sidled over.
Is the cart ready?
Yes, Mr. Glod. You filled up the horses with oats.
Just like you said, Mr. Glod. Okay.
The silence was velvet, and it had that quality of suction found in the patrician's study and in holy places and deep canyons engendering in people a terrible desire to shout or sing or yell their name. It was a silence that demanded, "Fill me up." Somewhere in the darkness, someone coughed. Ashfelt heard his name hissed from the side of the stage. With extreme reluctance, he sidled over to the darkness where Dibbler was frantically beckoning him.
"You know that bag?" said Dibbler.
"Yes, Mr. Dibbler. I put it..." Dibbler held up two small but very heavy sacks.
"Tip these in and be ready to leave in a big hurry."
"Yes, that's right, Mr. Dibbler, because Glod said..."
"Do it now."
Glod looked around. "If I throw away the horn and helmet and this chainmail shirt," he thought, "I might just get out of here alive. What's he doing?" Buddy put down the guitar and walked into the wings. He returned before the audience had realized what was happening. He was carrying the harp. He stood facing the audience. Glod, who was closest to him, heard him murmur, "Just once. Come on. Just one more time, and then I'll do whatever you want. See? I'll pay for it." There were a few faint chords from the guitar. Buddy said, "I mean it, see?" There was another chord. "Just once." Buddy smiled at an empty space in the audience and began to play. Every note was as sharp as a bell and as simple as sunlight, so that in the prism of the brain it broke up and flashed into a million colours. Glod's mouth hung open, and then the music unfolded in his head. It wasn't music with rocks in, although it used the same doors. The fall of the notes conjured up memories of the mine where he'd been born, and dwarf bread, just like Mum used to hammer out on her anvil, and the moment when he'd first realized that he'd fallen in love. He'd still got the nugget somewhere. He remembered life in the caves under Copperhead, before the city had called him, and more than anything else, he wanted to be home. He'd never realized that humans could sing whole. Cliff laid aside his hammers. The same notes crept into his corroded ears, but in his mind they became quarries and moorlands. He told himself, as emotion filled his head with its smoke, that right after this he was going to go back and see how his old mum was, and never leave ever again. Mr. Dibbler found his own mind spawning strange and disturbing thoughts. They involved things you couldn't sell and shouldn't pay for. The lecturer in recent runes thumped the crystal ball.
The sound is a bit tinny," he said.
"Get out of the way, I can't see," said the Dean.
Recent runes sat down again. They stared at the little image.
"This doesn't sound like music with rocks in," said the bursar. "Shut up," said the Dean.
He blew his nose. It was sad music, but it waved the sadness like a battle flag. It said the universe had done all it could, but you were still alive. The Dean, who was as impressionable as a dollop of warm wax, wondered if he could learn to play the harmonica. The last note faded. There was no applause. The audience sagged a little as each individual came down from whatever reflective corner they'd been occupying. One or two of them murmured things like, "Yeah, that's how it is," or, "You and me both, brother." A lot of people blew their noses, sometimes on other people. And then reality snuck back, as it always does. Glod heard Buddy say very quietly, "Thank you." The dwarf leaned sideways and said out of the corner of his mouth, "What was that?" Buddy seemed to shake himself awake.
"What? Oh, it's called Sioni Bodda. What do you think?"
"It's got whole," said Glod. "It's definitely got whole."
Cliff nodded. When you're a long way from the old familiar mine or mountain, when you're lost among strangers, when you're just a great big aching nothingness inside, only then can you really sing whole.
"She's watching us,"
whispered Buddy.
"The invisible girl," said Glod, staring at the empty grass.
"Yes."
"Oh, yes. I can definitely not see her. Good. And now, if you don't play music with rocks in this time, we're dead."
Buddy picked up the guitar. The strings trembled under his fingers. He felt elated. He'd been allowed to play it in front of them. Everything else was unimportant now. Whatever happened next didn't matter.
"You ain't heard nothing yet," he said.
He stamped his foot.
"1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Glod had time to recognize the tune before the music took him. He'd heard it only a few seconds before, but now it swung. Ponder peered into his box.
"I think we're trapping this, Arch-Chancellor," he said, but I don't know what it is."
Ridcully nodded and scanned the audience. They were listening with their mouths open. The harp had scoured their souls, and now the guitar was hot-wiring their spines. and there was an empty patch near the stage. Ridcully put a hand over one eye and focused until the other eye watered, and then he smiled. He turned to look at the Musicians' Guild and saw to his horror that Satchelmouth was raising a crossbow. He seemed to be doing it with reluctance. Mr. Cleet was prodding him. Ridcully raised a finger and appeared to scratch his nose. Even above the sound of the playing, he heard the twang as the crossbow's string broke, and to his secret delight, a yelp from Mr. Cleet as a loose end caught his ear. He hadn't even thought of that. "I'm just an old softy. That's my trouble," Ridcully said to himself.